Baruch Hashem. Ready? Rolling. Okay, so we have Rafi. Rafi, you can move closer. That's a lot. I hope many are listening across the world, but right here there's plenty of space. Today's Dafka, a very fascinating shiur. Okay, first of all, today, let's give the date. Today is Sunday, the 24th of March, 2019. And I remember as a kid, we used to say, Heintes Purim, Magen Zeus, give me a nickel and wach me a rice. And it translates, today is Purim, tomorrow's not, it's over. Give me a nickel and throw me out. Today you would have to say, give me a dollar, give me $5, because what a nickel would buy then, I don't think you can, New York Times was under a nickel, it was like 3 cents. Today in New York Times, what is it, the Daily New York Times, $1.25 or something. So, wow, we'd have to adjust it. A few comments on contemporary matters. This fell apart again. The story of that letter that the Rav attributed to the Rav's signature, did he really write it? Didn't he write it? I have to tell you, it continues to haunt people across the world. And I don't know. There's no solution that I can reach, that I can talk about. But maybe it has to be researched until someone can come up with a definitive answer. Because it is an interesting question that someone would come along and forge a letter in the name of the Rav. To me, it's inconceivable. But all right, anything is possible. All right, let's pick up here. We have a question that haunts us, and I'm going to add a certain level. Why it particularly? I gather you had problems with traffic today.
Yeah,
it's raining.
Vic is right behind me. He'll be here.
Yeah. Okay. Good. We haven't said a word yet. I want to add another level, what haunts me, and we're going to continue with this, very interesting sources. But you see, the conservative movement, and I'm talking about the conservative movement back in the 1950s, I'm talking about people I knew, conservative rabbis I knew. What was their attitude? Their attitude was, of course it's better if you don't drive on Shabbos. Of course it's Chilul Shabbos. Most of them were Shomer Torah and Mitzvot. But when the Rabbinical Assembly came along in the early 50s and permitted driving to shul, part of the reasoning was these people are going to be Mechallel Shabbos anyway. At least if they come to shul, for those 2 hours, 2.5 hours, they won't be Mechallel Shabbos. And that's exactly what was said. I mean, I knew one of the people who signed the tshuva, there were three names. One of them was Teddy Friedman. I knew Teddy Friedman intimately. He was the rabbi of the conservative temple right near where we built the first Orthodox shul. We're talking about Maplewood, South Orange. Louis Levitsky was rabbi of the Reconstructionist conservative temple. Herb Weiner was rabbi of the Reformed temple. Interestingly enough, Herb Weiner was a clandestine Orthodox Jew. And I don't know if all his children, but certainly part of his children are Shomrei Torah, Mitzvah 100%. So it was an interesting phenomenon. But here is Teddy Friedman, one of the signatures. The other one was Rabbi Agus, and the other one was the rabbi from Detroit, Rabbi Adler. And all of them came from a staunch Orthodox background. Rabbi Agus was a Talmud Mufak of Rabbi Revel, of Moshe Soloveitchik afterwards. He was a big Talmud Chacham. Anyone from Baltimore will tell you that the boys from Ne Yisrael used to visit him clandestinely, and if they had a difficult Gemara, they'd sit with him. And he became a Reconstructionist, all right? It's hard to conceive, but this is the reality in life. There's freedom of choice. And Teddy Friedman, you know, on his own personal life, you'll read Washington. I don't want to go into it now, but I've often repeated one of my major moments in the rabbinate in Essex County, where you're from, and what I did to Teddy Friedman in a public debate. And I'm not, you know, I look back now, it's not that I'm not proud of it, But I feel bad that I had to embarrass him. But I did make the point, and people today, I don't know, only God can tell me how many souls Hashem Torah mitzvah because of what I did that night. All I can tell you is one of the key families went over the hill. They told me afterwards we felt uncomfortable in the conservative movement. We were searching, and what you did with Rabbi Friedman pushed us. And later they went in Aliyah. They had many children. Who knows how many grandchildren there are today, great-grandchildren. So, and I spoke with Teddy Friedman, and again, his attitude was exactly what we will find in part of the Torah world. That why are we fooling ourselves? They're Mechallel Shabbos. They're going to drive. They're going to go shopping on Shabbos. Isn't it better they should drive to shul and spend 2 hours, 2.5 hours in prayer and worship, reading of the Torah, in a kiddush, at least not being Mechallel Shabbos. And this is what haunts me. Because you're going to see the same approach comes up time and again, in the people dealing with this very issue. All right, you can say, obviously, that there's a big difference. We're not permitting driving to shul. We're not writing a tshuva. We're not writing a response, and we're not signing off. I agree there's a big difference. But you know how far this has gone? You have shuls today where parking lots are open on Shabbos. And I told you, when I was in Atlanta, Georgia, the parking lot is open on Shabbos. It's always been. And in Atlanta, they told me that there are people who drove to shul and then became Shomrei Shabbos. But a parking lot open, Stamford, Connecticut, I told you, the parking lot is open Shabbos. The rabbi is my student. But he told me he inherited the situation. And one thing I can tell you, when you inherit a situation in a synagogue from a very popular rabbi, and Rabbi Joe Ehrenkranz was worshipped, he was the rabbi of Stamford, Connecticut, you're not going to be able to change it. And I told you, I was flabbergasted. It was Shavuos time I was there. And I forget when the Bar Mitzvah was it Shavuos? Was it Shabbos Shavuos? I forget how it fell. And right after this kid from a very prominent family, I recognized the name. His great uncle wrote the biography of Theodor Herzl. And the kid goes to day school. And he davens from Amid. He leyens, gives a drasha. And then I see them driving out of the parking lot. I come out of shul to walk back to the rabbi's house. There they are driving out of the shul on Shabbos. I'm told that Chabad, there are places where Chabad has a parking lot that's open Shabbos. I don't know if it's true or not, but I was told there are some places like that. So this haunts me, because where do we draw the line between the Vah Hashem and between conservative innovations? But okay, we have to deal with it halachically, and we have to try our best to see if we can solve the problem. Now, Reb Menashe Klein, you'll see the tshuva now, I'll deal with it. I would use the word, he's really trying his best. He's not extreme at all. He really is trying his best to solve the problem. You may use the word he's naive. But then again, when it comes to Torah, we all have to be naive. If we're not naive, I can tell you, I grew up, if someone would have told me in the early 50s when I was learning, and the 50s, I mean, that's the decade that I probably learned the most in my life in Shas and Paiskim, and someone would have told me, well, what do you think will be with the Jewish people? Well, we're going to have a few million Shomer Shabbos Jews within 20, 30 years. They would have, what are you, naive? What are you, stupid? What are you, foolish? You have to be naive. If you're not naive, if you're going to accept reality and just be negative and pessimistic, you'll never achieve anything. So I have to say, you'll see in a moment, I'll let you judge, is he overly naive? But here, this is the classic situation. And what I said last week is very important too. When we were growing up, those of us that are hitting the range of 70 here, I'm older, but that range, eh? When we were growing up, who would ever dream there'd be a massive outreach? Today it's a massive industry. You're talking an industry, I wouldn't be surprised, tens of millions of dollars are poured in. Baharaya, right here in Rishkolel, the young rabbis are paid to come to class to learn how to deal with outreach. Now, if someone's putting up that money, I can tell you, Shvutami, we benefited one Jew, George Rohr. George Rohr, this is the Rohr Foundation, R-O-H-R, it's a very prominent name. His foundation, his family gives it tens of millions of dollars a year, it could even be more, but their main thrust is to outreach. And he loves outreach. And I can tell you another story. I've met very wealthy people. All right, so very wealthy people come to Israel. They go to the King David. I'm not saying this negatively. They go to the King David Hotel. All right, they go to the Kotel. They'll go daven, come back to the hotel, go to the pool. Their wives are in the pool. All right, you're coming to the King David Hotel. You're paying to get the service, to enjoy yourself. I understand it. George Rohr, I can tell you, Eidut Nemana, that these eyes and these ears saw and heard it. He would come into Israel, his wife would go to the pool, he would go to Shvatami. Why to Shvatami? He loved to talk with the Balei Tshuva from Russia. To him it was inspiring. Chabad, many of the Chabad houses on campus are supported by the Rohr Foundation. And today, it's a major, I don't have a better word than the word industry. It's not something mabakach, it's not something just Esha Torah or Sameach, Machon Meir, it's way beyond. And you take NCSY, and here, Kol HaKavod to the OU. You can't start to appreciate this. All the money they make in Kashrut, all the profit, it's all turned over to NCSY, and you were the controller. Am I telling the truth or not? I see the programs they run. And I read an estimation to make a kid from is over $50,000. What does that mean? You got to send the kid to camp. You got to send them to Israel. Whatever they do, all these programs, they're paying part of it. It's not that the family pays something, obviously, but they're paying part of it. They're subsidizing it, if I can use that word. And Kol HaKavod. Now, so here this Russian calls. Generally, he invites Russians to his Friday night meal, this wonderful person, Rabbi Yosef Zuba, and he tells them to come early. And here, this Russian calls that he can't come, he evidently has to work, he'll be an hour and a half late. In other words, an hour and a half into Shabbos. Should he still come? And then this is the question he's asking Rabbi Nasha Klein. It's one thing to people come an hour before Shabbos, a half hour before Shabbos. All right, but here they're going to come. How are they going to come? They're going to come by bus. All right, these are not wealthy people. They're just newcomers. Evidently, if this was an American Sheila, newcomers to America. When Yomo reached America, what year did you reach America? 1992. You write right after the fall of the Communist Empire. Wow. So he reaches America in 1992. Did you have a car right away? Does your father have a car today?
Yeah.
Okay, so today your father has a car, but right away you came a greenhorn. You don't get off the plane and you have a car, so they come by bus. No, so you get involved with the bus, you get involved with the... Certainly Malacha de Rabbanan, I mean money, etc. Could be Malacha de Oraita too. You drop it in, the coin, it registers today with the computerization. Could be Surim de Oraita. Number one. Number two, the Jew is coming, he's carrying. It's before Erev, 1992 in America. And by the way, this tshuva is from 2002. So it's not ancient history. You get involved with, you're carrying. And he said, the Oraita, Hotzah, Rishut HaRabim, the Oraita, could very well be. And he mentions all this in the tshuva. But when he's going to come an hour and a half late, then certainly he's going to do Isurim. So Rabbi Nasha Klein says, you know what, you should answer him that when he's coming an hour and a half late and it's your invitation. You see, if you wouldn't be inviting him directly and the man has choice, he can go to a store, he can go home, he can relax, he can watch television, or he can be shot. He has total choice. where he has total choice, there's no lifnei yiva lo tein michshel. I'll deal with that. I'll show you the Gemara later today. But there's one source in the Gemara. But there he has total choice. But here you're inviting him. You're inviting him, so you wind up with a situation where lifnei yiva lo tein michshel. All right? So he says, so if he's going to come an hour and a half later, then it would seem to me you have to tell him he should come by foot, he shouldn't come by car, he shouldn't come by bus, he's not allowed to carry anything, but he should come himself. And if he doesn't listen to you, then it's not your problem. There's no lifnei yiva lo tein michshel. And, all right, is he naive? Can you imagine Yomo's father and mother got off the plane, they're invited Friday night, and they tell them not to come by bus, and not to carry. Do you think your parents would listen? What do you say, Yomo? Would they start to understand? Would they start to comprehend? In Kiev, did you know anything about carrying on Shabbos? No. So Yomo was shaking his head, no, we have Eidet Nemanah. But, you know, what can I tell you? I've been in the rabbinate. My heart is pained. I know this feeling. Who am I fooling? I get up and tell my Bala Batim, please do not drive to Shul on Shabbos. Tell me when Maplewood was first organized. Today I would imagine, I would doubt if there are many people or any people who drive to Shul on Shabbos. All of America has changed. But 1962, who were the Bala Batim? Who's interested in Orthodox Shul? Who cares? Suburban Essex County. Newark still had a handful of Orthodox Jews left. Later they moved to Elizabeth. Elizabeth picks up as Bergen Street goes under.
West Orange
picks up. Exactly. West Orange today has errands opened in West Orange. Go and tell me in 62 that in West Orange there'll be a major kosher supermarket a 15-minute drive from here, a 10-minute drive, whatever it was. I said, what are you, crazy? But today, the whole way, Baruch Hashem, things have changed. But this is what he suggests to him. And he goes on, and he says, maybe I have another solution, he says. And you see, here, you see the beauty of Reb Menashe Klein. On this particular issue, we're going to contrast him with Reb Moshe Feinstein in a minute. And Reb Moshe, on this issue, unless someone can correct me listening, Reb Moshe on this issue is the greatest machmeh he is in any question he ever got. What Reb Moshe says has been quoted and re-quoted. No one agrees with Reb Moshe, but you'll see in a minute. But he's very trying. You can see Reb Menashe Klein, his heart goes out to the Shaila. Because he understands he was an immigrant to America. He knows about Europe. He knows what happened in communist Russia. When he was growing up in Galicia, Hungary, that area of the world, they knew very well that in communist Russia, Jews are being executed for expressing their religion. So Reb Menashe Klein says, let me give you advice. And I'm happy to see Baruch Hashem. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we're talking about you're inviting a Russian Jew to your table on Shabbos, and he says to you, I can only come an hour and a half into Shabbos. So Reb Menashe Klein says to him, maybe you should tell him, not rebuke him, not tell him what to do, but, and I'm quoting there Reb Menashe Klein, says, but explain to him that we Jews have to be Shomer Shabbos. This is what the Torah is about. This is what the Bible is about. And I can't drive on Shabbos. I can't take a bus. I can't carry in the public domain on Shabbos. And therefore, you have to understand, I would be offended if any Jew would take a bus or drive or carry to come to my house on Shabbos. It will greatly upset me. And Reb Menashe Klein says that this Jew will derive from the way you're speaking to him that it's not nice that he should come as a result of Chilul Shabbos. Will it work? Won't it work? I don't know. Because I know the way these Jews think. Again, I come back to the story in my building, which again, I'm telling a story which my eyes saw, my ears heard. But I'll never forget the story. In my building, there's one apartment. I've told you this over the decades. There are now two apartments, but originally there's one apartment that are a hegdish. Do you know what a hegdish is, Rafi? It's owned by a charity. What happened was a man on the Upper West Side who was not married but made a lot of money, after the Six Day War decided, Chalas, I've made enough money, I'm going in Aliyah, and he bought an apartment in our building. Our building was built right after the Six Day War. In other words, the building is 50 years old, and I'm living there 50 years. I'm from the original settlers in this building. Only a few families are alive over the time we are, but we had world-famous Rabbanim. So when this man furnished the apartment, today you can get everything in Israel. You don't have to bring furniture from America. If anything, it's stupid to bring furniture because Israeli apartments are smaller. Buy the furniture here so it fits properly. He furnished everything, apartment ready, and must be 1969, late or 1970, he dies of a heart attack. So he willed the apartment to Chevron Yeshiva. So at a certain point, the mechutnan of Rabbi Yitzchak Kavroni, their children were married, they're no longer alive, was an Adam Gadol, Rav Arya Leib Grusnes. He, if you look in Rav Moshe's Trivet, he was Av Beitin of London, he was Alitvisha. But an English gentleman with perfect English, with the king's accent, the queen's accent, a London Muthak, the Leib Arya. When Reb Moshe corresponds with him, the titles run two full lines of titles. This is my neighbor for about 10, 12 years. I used to speak with him and learning. It was a pleasure. An Adam Gadol. They say his wife, who seemed a quiet, reticent Rebbetzin, rumor had it that she wrote detective stories under a different name. So they shouldn't know the Rebbetzin is writing and publishing detective stories. Very brilliant lady, and very possible that it's true. So one Shabbos, Rabbi Yalev comes home from shul. I always daven 6:30, and he davened at the 8:15 minyan in Noel Rivka. So it's now about 10:30, 11 o'clock. And I went downstairs maybe to meet my wife and children coming. My daughter's coming back from shul. And there are two kids from the Bodetsky family, Lo Aleinu, great-great-grandchildren of the Brisker Rav in Yerushalayim, not Ravelvo, but we're going back much earlier. I'll think of the name, but the Brisker Rav, Diskin, Rabbi Yehoshua Leib Diskin, Ur Einiklach. And these kids, Shabbos morning in front of the building, are writing with chalk on the ground. So Rabbi Yalev Grusnes comes home from shul, and he bends down and in his anglicized Hebrew says to them, Yiladim, Shabbos Hayom, Asur, what you're doing, it's forbidden, it's Shabbos. And he's telling them, rebuking them in a nice way, and the kids look up at him, perfectly innocent children, how to say the truth. They say, anachnu chiloniyim, anachnu lo datiyim. Do you understand that answer? We're in a different world. We're secular. We're not religious. The religion is for you. No, they're not saying anything bad. Anachnu mishtamshim begir b'shabbat. We use chalk. We're not religious. You see, this is their mentality. Today in Israel is the same mentality. You'll go to Ran Chuldai, the mayor of Tel Aviv. I'm not anti-religious, but I don't observe Shabbos. I need stores on Shabbos. You observe, fine, that's your privilege. They have no concept that Jews are obligated to observe. This is now seven Ishma, this is the secret of our survival. They have no concept like that. The same thing here. Rabbi Menashe Klein says, talk with them nicely. Put the blame on yourself. Don't tell them what to do. Will it help? I doubt it. But it's a very, very fascinating tshuva. At the end of the tshuva, it's interesting, there's a typographical mistake here. which even if this was, I'm sure this was already with a computer, but the computer doesn't catch it. I'll tell you what the mistake is, and at the end of the trivia, you see, so someone will come along and say, what are you getting all upset about? Look at Hillel HaZaken. Hillel HaZaken laid down the famous story, the Gemara in Yuma, with Hillel HaZaken laid down on the roof and was frozen to death, and it was Shabbos, he didn't have the money to pay, and they revived him. Tov sheyichallelu Shabbat she'achat kedei sheyishmeru Shabbatot habei. So see, here too, you might take the approach, and by the way, some of the people do take this approach, I'll give you sources, but you might take the approach, look, we're telling the people, drive to the family on Shabbos, drive to the meal on Shabbos, drive to the shul on Shabbos. We'll inspire him, and as a result of Chilul Shabbos for a year or two, he'll be Shomer Shabbos for the next 50 years. So he says right away, you don't have a concept like this, Lehefech. If you recall, a year ago he spent a lot of time, the Gemara at the start of Masechet Shabbos, you're not allowed to do a sin to help someone else not do a bigger sin. Remember taking the food, the bread, if you're baking bread, he put it in before Shabbos, take it off the side of the oven, that way he won't have an nisur of baking. No, he did something wrong, let him continue. Your job is not to do Chilul Shabbos, even to save someone else. So he says, yes, you're going to think that now will be Mochal Shabbos. Who guarantees you? Who can? And the words he use, Avsha Chakach, Yishmar HaShabbat Efsha, doesn't make sense. I think what it should be, Avsha Chakach Efsha Yishmar HaShabbat. Even though there's a chance, you see, you have to make it, the Hebrew has to make sense, the Efsher is in the wrong place. But, yeah, there's a chance, but you can't be sure. You're going to risk it? You're going to play games? You're going to tell them, Bimel Challah Shabbos, for this Shabbos, next Shabbos, the third Shabbos? Because maybe we'll turn you around. Doesn't work that way. You can't deal with a gamble. It's putting money down. Are the Yankees going to win the pennant this year? Are the Red Sox going to win the pennant? There are all types of odds out there. What will be? No, that's gambling. When it comes to halacha, we can't gamble. We have to do what's now. And now you can't be Mechal Shabbos, and you can't ask anyone else, aid anyone to be Mechal Shabbos. So halacha l'maisa, Reb Menashe Klein Paskins, is that if you give the person a choice, there's no lifnei iver. Is he happy with the situation? He's not happy, he's not unhappy. There's a pro and con here. See, this is a situation where there's no black and white. But halacha l'maisa, you have to invite him with provisos, that he can't be mechal Shabbos, that he can't come by bus, that he has to come early. You have to do the best you can. This is what I did in the Rabman at time and again. I told them that you can't drive the Shul Shabbos. All right? The conservative temple had a big parking lot. And when we began, two blocks away, they parked cars. Or they let the crippled people who came on canes, the doctor operate on them, so they let them off at the start of the street. And then the son or grandson parked the car two blocks away. It's not a happy situation. But this takes us to the question that we've asked and dealt with and lectured on extensively over the last 40 years, halacha. Jack always quotes me, and he's right, halacha doesn't exist in a vacuum. Here you're dealing with not just a pure halachic question, but a sociological, emotional, philosophic, hashkafic question as well. What is our approach? And I can tell you, that you take the Hasidic movement. A lot has been written on this, by the way, in this election campaign, because there have been some very insightful studies on what's happened in the Litvish world, the Hasidic world. But the Hasidic world, when it began, was a world of outreach. All the Hasidic stories, Jews doing terrible things, and the Rebbeim turned them around. Now give me a simple example. You have with the Baal Shem Tov, that he comes to this town and it's Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, and this person barely knows how to pray, and he gets so excited in davening, he takes a horn or he takes a shofar and he starts blowing it. And the Baal Shem Tov says that shofar opened the doors of heaven for the prayers. And so they take simple acts that are not in cognizance with the pure halacha, but we viewed it, oh, this is great. The Baal Shem Tov, the Kiruv Rehokim, the outreach. How did Hasidus begin? One Rebbe after another, the outreach. Go to the Lubavitcher, the first Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe, the Baal Tanya, what was it all about? And right down the line, you see outreach, outreach, outreach. You come to the modern period, Hasidim outreach, walk into Ger, and you're not a Ger Hasid, they're not interested in extending a hello to you, making you feel at home. The attitude is more, what are you doing? And particularly after World War II, who was engaged in outreach? Who cared about outreach? Lehefech, they were just trying to ghettoize and keep their own. And of course, that has to do with the fact that Hasidus was wiped out during World War II. You were worried stiff, ghetto, we got to survive. Lubavitch started outreach. Lubavitch basically returned to the original Hasidic concept. You with me, Dov? It's a return in time to the way Hasidus began. Ah, nowadays, Baruch Hashem, Vic, we're 70, 75 years after the Holocaust, there is a little change in the greater Hasidic world. Can anyone give me a strong example? The strongest example. All the newspapers picked this up. And I've been mentioning it already for a number of years. Bells. Bells today has a division that deals with outreach. And I had students who sought out their roots. It's an amazing thing. I mean, my wife comes from Bells of Hasidim, but I don't know. I don't see one grandchild interested in becoming a Bells of Hasid. But they deal with outreach today. Chabad is, I don't have to say, Chabad is built upon outreach, but Bells today, we'll see with Ger what will happen in the future. A lot is shaking now in Ger because this particular Rebbe is not as popular. Until now, every Rebbe in Ger was by acclamation. But this particular Rebbe, there is an undercurrent of, we could have had a better choice. I'm not a Ger Chassid, I can say it honestly. Who knows what will be afterwards, if Reb Shol will become Reb Shol Alter, it's a nephew, etc. It's a lot, or a first cousin. I have to check the Yichus, there may be a first cousin. A lot may happen, but outreach, critical. Without outreach, Hitler destroyed us. Without outreach, millions of Jews today, Shomer Torah Mitzvah. I'm not saying they're all tzaddikim. This, unfortunately, I learned the hard way. We have terrible scandals in our midst. I need not elaborate. Right here in Israel with sex scandals and Malki Leifer and what went on in Australia. And now they tell me there's going to be a lawsuit against Yeshiva University of people who were abused. I mean, it's very frightening. But at least there are millions of Jews who make an attempt to be Shomer Torah Mitzvah. So that's Reb Menashe Klein's answer. It's not a black and white answer. A lot depends upon circumstances. But tell them not to be Mechal Shabbos, not to take a bus, not to carry. Now,
but the bottom line is to tell them not to come if they can't be Shabbos.
If they're going to say to you, I'm going to come by bus, according to Reb Menashe Klein, he would tell them not to come. But we're going to see other opinions. We're just beginning. But you follow? He doesn't spell it out, but that's the inference from this tshuva. We'll see. Hold off. Now, you want to see how far this problem goes? If you recall our lectures on the chaplaincy. So, I got a very interesting email from Lakewood, a a sub Talmud, Tzvi Rubinfeld, and I'll read the first paragraph to you. I have a right to enhance my ego a little. Forgive me. I got a call right before Shabbos from a Talmud. I just told Yomo to email him how much I appreciate his call, but I don't know if he meant it or he was drunk. I got a call from a very prominent Talmud who thanked me for changing his life and etc., etc. I don't know. It made me very, I was very moved. Here's another. Shalom Rav Rakefet. My name is Zvi Rubinfeld. I live in Lakewood, New Jersey. I've been listening to your shiurim and lectures for some time and I really enjoy them. You have a lot of Talmidim in Lakewood. Thank you so much. And then he tells me about his yichus. Happened to know his maternal grandfather was Rabbi Chaim Pikier. He was a survivor, Talmud of Rabban. And I spoke about him, Rabbi Goldstein Shul. He used to teach years, was the Magid Shia. And he's talking about his grandfather, Milton Rubinfeld, who had learned under Rabbi Hutman Chaim Berlin. Under pressure from the National Jewish Welfare Board, Chaim Berlin needed to send two students as chaplains, and my grandfather volunteered as one of them. I believe the other one was someone named Chaim Gross. Anyone know Chaim Gross? I think I know the family. I think it's actually related to me through my brothers married to... my brother's brother-in-law is Gross. My grandfather had actually left the yeshiva already, but rejoined the yeshiva in order to volunteer as a chaplain and avoid getting drafted. Attached is a small piece in the Brooklyn Eagle. It's a Brooklyn newspaper where his grandfather is mentioned, the first Jewish chaplain to be assigned to the Aberdeen Proving Grounds, Maryland, since World War II, is Lieutenant Milton A. Rubinfeld of Williams Avenue. He is alumnus of the Rabbinical Academy, Masif, the Rabbi Chaim Berlin Parochial School. And he writes to me, he was assigned to Aberdeen Proving Grounds, and this was during the last 6 months of his 2 years of active service. My grandfather was first stationed in Fort Devens. He told me that when he first arrived, there was a Friday night Onik Shabbos, where buses from Massachusetts would drive in to join. In other words, wherever there were Jews in various army post bases, they drove in for the Onik Shabbos. In order to prevent the Chilul Shabbos, he arranged to have the Onik changed to Tuesday night. While the change did remain, people were upset with him. He admits that he was young at the time and probably should have handled it a lot better. And he was transferred to a quartermaster outfit that delivered supplies to air bases in the North Atlantic and was never sent to Korea. So in other words, what you see here, and I wish Yitz Rubin would be here, this is a real problem. Take a look. Here's a chaplain with an Onik Shabbat. And Jews want to know it's Shabbat, and the army's accommodating them, and buses are coming in from all over the greater area, and this Chaim Berlin fellow feels very guilty. He's running a show Friday night filled with Chilul Shabbos, and ultimately he switches it to Tuesday night. Now, how can he switch it to Tuesday night? What do you call it? It's not an Onik Shabbat. A celebration of Judaism. I mean, you can come up with the title, but you can imagine all the people who had a negative attitude towards him, and ultimately the army ships him away. If I understand correctly, it's a position where you're not dealing with so many soldiers anymore. It's a quartermaster, their logistics, their supplies. He doesn't have the audience or the oilim that he had before. Notice the words, I was young, I'd be older, I could handle it a lot better. And that's part of life too. Every rabbi, everyone in public service, I look back when I was 23 years of age in the rabbinate, believe me, I made a lot of mistakes in Lower Merion Synagogue. It was terrible. I look back, I should have had seichel, I should have done this, I should have done that, I should have spoken this way, I should have acted this way. But that seichel that comes with maturity. Not everyone matures. You have people who all their lives, you know, there's a good word that I often say, he's an Eloi, but he's an Eloi who never matured. The Rav was an Eloi, there's no two ways about it. But life matured him, his wife, his children, the situation in Massachusetts. The stories out of the 30s are not like the stories out of the 40s and the 50s. And he matured. There are other people who all their life remained Eloyim. I can mention, for instance, Reb Chaim Zimmerman. If you knew Reb Chaim Zimmerman, a gone idea. But it's hard to say he stopped being an Eloy. He always was an Eloy. You remember with the plate incident in Chicago, what went on? All right, these are personalities. It's not everyone. Sometimes your mind, you'll take the rocket shovel. I would say the rocket shovel was an Eloy Yotzim. But their stories, you read the making of a Gadol stories with the rocket shovel at Chaim Isaac Rishensky with chairs flying. I wouldn't exactly say that he was always the Eloy Yotzim. The rocket shovel, they just interviewed people who knew him. I saw on someone sent me a link. So I knew the stories. But the rocket shovel would say in Reb Yitzchok Chanan, Efsha hata fashtanen at Taisvus. Maybe he understood at Taisvus, all right? That's the rocket shovel. He was on a level. That's why we don't paskin there. If I can quote Rakefet, I dealt with the rocket shovel in depth over the decades. He had psukim that were unbelievable. But we don't paskin that way, because that's an Eloy Yotzim. We have to paskin within a normal frame of shas and paskim. We can't disregard all the achronim. But the rocket shovel, so this is youth. You can't redo the clock. But I was so stupid in Lower Merion that I can tell you, Eidat Nemana, a number of years ago, a Talmud of mine, who you know, David Goldis, wanted me to be scholar in residence in Lower Merion, come back 45 years later, 40 years later, come back, 55 years later, in 1962, yeah, 60 years later, come back and be scholar in residence, be interesting, what became this, that. And the chairman of the education committee was his cousin. So his cousin said, we have no money. So David said, I'll give you the money. You make him. And then the cousin told the truth. Quote, some of the elders of the congregation would be offended. You understand? The Ad Kedei Kach, that 40, 50, 60 years later. All right, I just told David that all the elders are gone. Unfortunately, in the last few years, they all were called to the heavenly court. But believe me, the new generation doesn't know what went on, doesn't know the name Rakefet, and there's no interest, but that's life. But you see, when he tells his grandson the story, he admits it was a lot of aggravation. But the halacha lemaisa, what do you do? You're the chaplain. You got to run a Friday night service. You got to run a non-ek Shabbat. What else can a Jewish chaplain do? And people, buses are coming in. Wow. You should know, and this will come up again, I once spoke with Rabban Soloveitchik about this, because it always troubled me. I mean, I have to be honest, Chilul Shabbos is Chilul Shabbos. Where am I different than a conservative rabbi if I know that my minyan is based upon people coming? So Rabban Soloveitchik said to me, look, you got to organize a shul. Wherever Jews live, there has to be a shul. You're not responsible for how this shul gets started. It gets started, there's a shul, you announce, it's open, come. All right, you hope that you'll have a minyan of Shomrei Shabbos, but you don't have to take it to heart if the shul originally began through the doctor, through his patients, etc. But, all right, this is the question. Reb Moshe takes an entirely different approach. And here you're going to hear what Reb Moshe says. It is very, very extreme, I would say. Quoted and re-quoted, but this is Reb Moshe. And I'm quoting from the first volume of Vigrat Moshe, Orech Chaim, which came out in 1959. And I'm quoting two tshuvot, one after another, Tzadi Chet and Tzadi Tet. Now, the questioneers are interesting too. Tzadi Chet, 98, the person who asked is Harav Aryeh Moshe Eliyahu Kaplan, the tshuva is from 1955. I've been told that that's the famous Kaplan who did the translations, who died young, and I think he was in his late 40s, early 50s. Aryeh Kaplan, is that the name he goes by, Aryeh in English? And he worked for the OU, he did translations. They say he was a Gon Adir, Baal Tshuva, by the way. I don't think he was born into an Orthodox Torah framework, but a Baal Tshuva. And the question is from him, and doesn't give more details, except he says the Balabatim in the shul want to make a minyan for the children, so they should know how to daven. A youth minyan, this today is Maisim B'chol Yom in all the shuls. You have a youth minyan, a young marries minyan, a teenager minyan. You have shuls, Kanayin Hara, where there are 8, 9 different minyanim. I have Talmidim, Ephraim Goldberg, I think in his shul, there are endless minyanim Shabbos. Rabbi Steve Przanski, the Pruz, in his shul, there are many minyanim Shabbos. So they want to make a minyan. But it's clear that all these children are going to come by car, are going to be delivered, and they live very far. And there's no doubt in my mind, Rabbi Kaplan writes to Rabbi Moshe, that they will come by car. Now, it's interesting, this shul has to be in suburbia. In the big cities where they had shuls, all right, you take Flatbush, you take the Bronx, take Manhattan, essentially, everyone can walk the shul. Within the shul, you take Rabbi Luchstein's shul, Kehillat Yeshurun, KJ, tremendous buildings, endless Jews living there. To take the west side, take the whatever you want, Queens, the Bronx. Suburbia, where you have private homes with lawns, Ribbono Shel Olam, in order to find 100 Jewish families, you probably have to draw a circumference around the shul of at least a mile. Now, in suburbia, everyone drives, no one walks, and of course a kid is spoiled, he's not going to walk, his parents drive him all over, so they're going to drive him to shul, if not the parents, if they have someone in the house who works, what do they call them, a maid, a guardian, whatever, so the kid is being driven, and what are you going to say? So you might take the approach, wait a minute, this kid is a katan, he's not obligated in Torah and mitzvot yet. No, so you can drive him on Shabbos, he's not obligated. No, if he's not obligated to observe Shabbos, is he obligated to daven? Reb Moshe says, the chichinuch tefillah adif mechinuch mitzvot Shabbat? You mean to say, more important to teach him how to daven than to teach him how to observe Shabbat? And Reb Moshe says, absolutely not. And he tells Rabbi Kaplan, Vadai, chas v'chalila, lahaskim, l'davar kazeh, shehu lo lechanech l'mitzvot, ala adarava, lahancham l'hipuch, chas v'chalila. And he says to the rabbi, you have to tell them that this is not chinuch mitzvah, this is not a good thing, this is chas v'shalom, you're educating kids to be mechalel Shabbos. And this is Reb Moshe, this is not still the most extreme, we're going to get there in the next tshuva, but this is quite an extreme approach. And Reb Moshe is telling him, absolutely not, period. There's nothing to talk about. So the rabbi evidently wrote back to Reb Moshe. They're having this whole discussion. And the rabbi says, what can I do? And this is the old story in the United States where the Balabatim rule the shuls. This is the advantage of Chabad. Chabad owns their shuls. It's an investment. No one can tell them what to do. You see, this is the greatness of Chabad. All over the world, the shuls have a machitza, the shuls are Orthodox. Tomorrow, I'm going to show you the bad point of Chabad, why I came back shaking like a leaf from my sojourn in Italy, and what disturbed my peace of mind on the whole trip home, and the question that haunts me until this very second. But the essential service, Chabad owns the shul. A Hasidic Rebbe owns the shul. This is why after World War II, Rebbeim and Shtickel Rebbeim all over Brooklyn, all over the Bronx at one point, all over Queens, Rebbeim opened shuls. You could daven there or not daven there. Ultimately, they attracted the Jews. It became convenient. The minyan, the kiddush, the food that was served, the Rebbetzin's kugel. But no one can tell a Rebbe what to do. He owns the shul. But when you come in, as we saw in the Monday class, when Bernard Drachman becomes rabbi of a synagogue in New York, and the Balabatim tell him, we voted to take the Mechitza down, Rabbi, sorry, but we're the bosses here. And that's exactly what rabbis were up against. So this poor rabbi says to Rabbi Moshe, what should I do? And Rabbi Moshe answers him, you have to rebuke them, you have to set the record straight, but I don't know what else you can do. You should talk to the children individually that they should come by foot, but if all this doesn't help, you did your share. You were mochiach, you opposed, you made a public stand. There's nothing more you can do. My dear students, can you tie together this last part of the tshuva with contemporary Israeli news that the world is shaking and a poor guy named Aaron Rakefet gets a letter from Brooklyn of wonderful sub-Talmidim rebuking the Rebbe for telling them to come in Aliyah? No, tie it together. The Balabatim, the rabbi. Oh, Rafi, you've heard the name Meir Kahana? Did you know Meir Kahana?
No.
I knew him intimately. My Madrichim Bnei Akiva, the Rosh Ken, I'm Skan Rosh Ken. I taught his two daughters, Sippy, Zichrona Levracha, and Tova. Taught his daughter-in-law, Nitza. Taught his son-in-law, Rabbi Moshe Kaplan, known to me as Mark the Snark. Rabbi Moshe Kaplan today, Shlita. People grow up, become bigger than their rabbi. No, I knew Meir Kahana. The world is shaking about Meir Kahana, the Supreme Court. What went wrong with Meir? Part of life, right, it's true. In 1932, I believe it was, or 37, I have to check my own writings. I think it's 37. He was born in 32. I think it was 5 at the time. His family was wiped out by Arab terrorists. They were coming back from Tel Aviv to Tzfat. He's come from an Israeli family beside his father, Tzfat, Kahana, Kohanim. They were wiped out. 5 members of his family were killed coming back from a wedding. Well, if that happened to you, Dov, you'd also become a little bit more extreme. You follow me? All right, but that's only part of it. In order to succeed in life, there's one lesson we have to learn. We have to be a team player, okay? You have to be a team player. This is part of politics. Rakefet can be the smartest guy in the world and thinks he knows everything. Other people know more than you and are smarter than you and have more insight than you. You have to be a team player. Not always do you have to stand and say, I am right. You have to know to be flexible, to bend, to yield. Fine, majority, go along. Good. Meir would have been a tremendous success. But one event happened in his life that totally changed him. Personality, added to his personality, made it more profound. He became rabbi in Howard Beach. Howard Beach, a new area. And then they're building it up, big apartments, first rabbi. And he went in Thursday night, he was influencing the children, the youngsters. Kids coming home demanding kashrut, kids coming home demanding Shabbos. And he took them Thursday night before Shabbos. And without permission, they put a machitza in the shul. That was Thursday night. The balabatim came in Friday night. They went hysterical. On Sunday or Monday, they fired the rabbi. Read about it in Washington. That changed Meir's personality. He could never be a team player again. He saw when you're a team player, when you're flexible, when you deal with balabatim, what they can do to Yiddishkeit. And this is exactly what Reb Moshe is writing here. You spoke to the children. There's not more you can do. The balabatim unfortunately rule. They're the ones who are going to make the decisions. It's their shul. And I'll tell you why balabatim think like this. This was when I was going through my difficulty in Lower Merion Synagogue, so I went crying to the yeshiva placement division. And Rabbi Liam Stitzkin, Zichrono Livracha, a name you don't recognize anymore. Life moves on. He said something to me that absolutely true. He said the balabatim will take the point of view, this is their shul, this is this area, this is where they live, this is where they put their money into. The rabbi is here today, gone tomorrow. Follow? You're a rabbi in Howard Beach. You want to reach Manhattan. You want to reach the big shuls. Everyone has a goal. Everyone has a desire. You're a transient. You're not here permanently. And that's very true. And you can't blame balabatim. Vic, you cannot blame balabatim for thinking that way. The snow is going to fall where they live. Not when the rabbi takes a shtela in the heart of Florida. You follow? So Reb Moshe here is very smart. On one hand, he asks 100%. On the other hand, he's telling, if this is Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, the famous Rabbi Kaplan, people tell me he was a gon, a tzaddik. They ein gomrim alav et ha-halel. He's telling him, look, there's nothing more you can do. You've done talchacha, you've done your job. The balabatim run the shul. You can only have as much a say as a rabbi can have. Beyond that, you got to live with the reality. So this is the first tshuva, but there's no question that Reb Moshe doesn't hem or haw. He asks running a youth minion when you know they're going to drive up on Shabbat. Reb Moshe, 100%. The next tshuva is even more extreme. Frighteningly more extreme. The next tshuva is from 1953. The one we just read is from 1955. This is from 1953 to Reb Naftali Kalbach of Detroit. Now that's a name, it's the Kalbach family obviously. Reb Shlomo's father was Naftali, but as far as I recall, he was on the west side. Maybe he was in Detroit originally, or it could be it's a cousin. Could be this is, again, a Reb Naftali, who may be the father of Reb Shlomo of Chaim Berlin. Follow? I don't know. If someone can help me out here, I'll be happy. And here, the exact same question. Can you invite people to come to Daven on Shabbos if you know Sheyichalalu Shabbat b'nisiyah b'mishins? And that is the old Yiddish b'kaz. How do I still know it? Believe me, when I was growing up already, Reb Moshe and later Tshuvot uses the word kar, kuf aleph resh. But how do I know Mishin? A Mishinka? Because on Rabbi Revel's 25th Jot site, they had a memorial in the YU Beit Medrash. And Rabbi Saul B. Friedman, who was one of the original mismachim of the yeshiva 1919, and I told you the first American-born mismach of the yeshiva. He was born in Pittsburgh, was later rabbi of Young Israel of Washington Heights, and was a lawyer. Saul B. Friedman has children living in Israel. So Saul B. Friedman was maspid Rabbi Rebel as a Talmud. And he told the story, and he used the word, and the Mishinka had gavat for us, and the machine was waiting for us. And I was a kid. Who ever heard the word Mishinka? A washing machine, a machine. So they told me that was the original word for a car. So here, Rabbi Moshe is evidently, Rabbi Kalbach used the word machines. So for future generations, note that this word is a car. And Rabbi Moshe answered him to invite people who will come with Chilul Shabbos. They live too far to walk. Where it's definite, you're inviting them is equivalent to saying, drive up to the shul on Shabbat. It is absolutely forbidden. You're sitting, Rafi, your life insurance is paid up. Okay? Then Reb Moshe says, V'hu old garua melifnei isa shelifnei iver lotitain mikshal. It's even worse than just putting a stumbling block in front of the eyes of the innocent. Shaharehu old be'isa meisit umediach. Rav Moshe compares this to telling someone to be oveid avodah zara. Ameisit umediach. Chayiv mita, the Torah, what a sin. Telling people, come, be oveid avodah zara. You know what that means in the Torah? Meisit umediach. You're chayev skila. You have to stone the people that lead you astray. You have to stone the people who are talking about idol worship and trying to enhance you. Oh, chayev mita. So everybody says, all right, not that far. That's only if they're telling you to be oveid avodah zarah. But nevertheless, when someone tells you to do something that is wrong, you may not be chayev skila, but klapei shmaya, in the eyes of heaven, you have a status of a mesich umedia. And the proof, you can look up the Gemara in Sanhedrin, daf chavtet, Chava and Adam HaRishon, when it comes to the apple, the Nachash entices them. Chava entices Adam HaRishon, and the Gemara deals with that episode that they are mesitim. No, what's the prohibition against eating of the tree of knowledge, the tree of life? It's not avodah zarah. It's only an iser lav. It's a prohibition that God decreed for Adam v'Chava. And yet the Gemara treats that like meisit umediach. If that's the case, alach at kama v'kama, if you're inviting people not just to do a lav, but to be mechalel Shabbat, to do part of the lametet malacha, to kick off a car, to drive a car, how many surim are involved? And you are inviting them? That's not just lifneifa. You have a status of a mesit. Avo bedinish shamayim, you will be punished as if you are a mesit. My dear students, those few lines are probably considered the most extreme position that Rav Moshe ever took. It means, Dov, you're in the Rabnit in Maplewood, South Orange. You're announcing Mincha at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Half the people are driving. You have a chalosh shame. Mesit. You announce Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur services? How did they get there? The shul is filled. I told you I had the same thing in, but the same thing in Venice. We're going on a guided tour of what survives from the ghetto, and there are three ancient synagogues that are still in use, particularly Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And the lady giving the guided tour, religious lady, all the Jews there seem to be religious, and she says on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, hundreds of people come into Venice, all the old timers. So I asked, where do they stay? And she barked at me, well, you know you can't drive on Yontif. She thought I was a Meisit to Meidiach. And she explained to me, they stay in the few homes in the ghetto, still Jews entertain. There are two hotels in the ghetto. They squeezed them all in. But wow, did she jump on me? You know you can't drive, like I'm a guy gummer, thinking of, you know, like a Reformed temple in Lawrence. All of you know in Lawrence, there's one tremendous Reformed temple standing a block and a half from Shari Tfila, 2.5 blocks from the White Shul. No one is there, Shabbos. They make a living. The place keeps open by their glatt kosher catering. And it's mamish in the Reformed temple. I was there for weddings. I walked in. I was shaking, looking around. I knew where I was. But all right, they know Easter, enjoy the food, lot, whatnot. And had a, that's what supports them. But Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they're filled. Hundreds drive in, miles around. They grew up in that temple before the Chassidim and the Orthodox overran the five towns. All right. Meisetu Meidiach. This is Reb Moshe. That's the earlier tshuva. You're trying to say Reb Moshe didn't go so far in the next tshuva. It could be, because you're dealing with youngsters too. But watch. But Reb Moshe says, look, if you have an audience where you have both those that come by machine and those that walk, so then you can make an announcement. And he says, certainly if you announce that there's services in the shul, you have in mind those that will walk, those that will observe Shabbos. You don't have a chalei shame of a meset. But Reb Moshe says, who knows, it could be lifnei yiver, that you're announcing opening the shul and you know that some will drive. So Reb Moshe, you see, is very amorphous here. But halacha lemaisa, there's no doubt in my mind that a rabbi in a shul making announcement services will be at this hour and that hour. That's having a shul. What else is the shul there for? But Reb Moshe is still amorphous, not absolutely certain. All right. Now the second half of the tshuva is very interesting. And this too, halacha lemaisa, again, it may be a world gone by, but believe me, this was a real world. All of us felt it on our besaria chazenu. I felt it. Your father felt it. Your uncle felt it. Vic has people, family in the rabbinate. We all felt it. And this poor rabbi, Naftali Kalbach, is asking Reb Moshe, you know, I belong, I'm rabbi, Orthodox shul, and the majority of the people don't act properly. Maybe I should leave the shul. What am I doing here? What am I accomplishing? And, you know, you take, again, I'll come to Stamford, Connecticut. Stamford, Connecticut, it's like two shuls in one. The downstairs minion is like a young Israel. They're an earlier minion, a Hashkamah minion, so-called. And the upstairs minion is like the old Orthodox temple of years ago. Take Lawrence today, Rabbi Kenny Haynes' temple, synagogue. What's it called? Bet Shalom. Right or wrong? Years ago, the overwhelming majority of people are not Shomer Shabbos. Today, it's a different story. But these were the old Orthodox shuls. Take Kilat Jeshurun. Who is Shomer Shabbos on the Upper East Side of New York? Reality. Toronto, I don't know. Big Orthodox shuls. I can't believe 40, 50 years ago, the majority was Shomer Shabbos. the big shuls. You had shtibbles, you had sideshows. So the rabbi says, maybe I should leave. And here Reb Moshe says, absolutely not. If you leave, miyim chebi adam. Who's going to rebuke them? Who's going to teach them? And don't give up. Reb Moshe says, ki ma'at min ha'har docher habay min ha'choshech. Ve'ulai to'il ha'macha'a la'habay yisurim. It could be rabbi preaching. This is, you have to be positive. You never know. A little bit light can drive away a lot of darkness. And you never know the influence you're going to have. And Vic here of Moshe is right on. This is life. This is, I told you, in South Orange, Maplewood, Lower Mary, Beth Ephraim. Remember I told you this family that came, and I'll never forget it. I used to seek out every Jewish family coming. I used to have a deal with the real estate agents, tell me if it's a Jewish family. And then I had a woman. I write about, that's the gangster I write about, that was her husband, Reed Washington. So she was a real estate agent, and she told me when a family out of Newark, they were moving out now, Newark was changing, so this family moves in, I go to see them, Rabbi, we are going to join your congregation, we belong to an Orthodox shul, but this year, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we're too tired from the move. We're going to skip it this year. That year they didn't. Remember I compared it to Pesach Sheni. I gave drushes like this on Pesach. Anyway, so you know, you teach, you eat your heart out. I saw nothing. Many decades later, I get an email from their son, who was in my Talmud Torah, my student, listening to my Shayurim and YUTorah.org. So what does that tell you? You see, you never know what you can accomplish. I come to East Brunswick, and they tell me that this grandmother here waiting to see you, she says she owes her Yiddishkeit to you. She was my student in Concourse Center of Israel, 1960, 1961. And if I didn't want to believe her, she gave me the siddur, which I inscribed to her. I remembered exactly. She showed me the stamp book I gave her. Baruch Shalom. So Rav Moshe is absolutely right. He tells the rabbi, look, you don't leave. You're there. It's not a happy situation at times, but if you won't be there, who knows what will happen to the shul. And then Reb Moshe answers off, Achu kol zman shemitnagim beveit haKnesset kshura, aval im yesh nochas v'chalila miseide beit haKnesset kemo sheyisalku hamachitza, שבין אנשים לנשים, או שישנו את במקסת סדה התפילה כירת התורה, מחויבים כל ירי השם להסתלג מלהיות members שם. Reb Moshe, members, we would use today, מתן חיבו חברים, but you see Reb Moshe, that this, you can remain there, כל זמן that they don't play with the machitza. The machitza was the vanished buffalo. What went on, and this began already 100 years ago, women get the right to vote. Remember we spoke about it, in the other class with Rav Kook. I got some interesting comments on Rav Kook and the women voting and not voting. And by after World War I, the suffragettes, the right to vote, the women, the machitza, second-rate citizens, all that goes with it. And what Rabbi suffered over Mechitza, you have no idea. This I can tell you, you take Rabbi Bernard Berzin, Zichrono Livracha, he's one of the top rabbis, Brooklyn, what a speaker, a graduate of Yeshiva in the 1930s, the father of the famous Rabbi Berzin brothers who were here. Some of you know who I'm talking about, Hananya Berzin, and what's his brother's name? Hananya Isaiah Berzin, very fabulous rabbis, Talmidei Chachamim, and their father, what a speaker, what a rabbi. And he goes to Europe, this is a true story, by boat one summer, he and his wife, some other colleagues, they're taking a respite from the rabbinate, going on a tour of Europe. Could be they went to Israel afterwards, was by boat then, before planes, and he comes back to Brooklyn to his shul. While he was gone, the Balabatim took the machitza down. And they finally made a compromise with him. They put a rope up, a cord, that separate seating, and a cord to separate, a cord. He had a heart attack. He's one of the early stories where they did some of the innovative heart surgery, which they do today, was on Rabbi Beryl Berzon. But what rabbis went through with the machitza. So that was number one, the Balabatim, the machitza. You take the Bronx, the biggest Orthodox shul in the Bronx was Concourse Center of Israel. Concourse Center of Israel had no machitza. It had separate seating. I taught there and I ran the Shabbos minyan for the kids. That was downstairs where there was a Hashkama minyan with a machitza. And then when we took it over for the kids, there was a machitza. But upstairs, there was no machitza. And that was a lot. There was anyone who was shomer Shabbos in that neighborhood davened there. But that was it. The Balabatim who controlled, refused, what? Men and women? That was the first terrible problem that repeated itself throughout all of the United States and probably Canada as well. Although in Montreal, it's very interesting, a big shul that was identified with the conservative movement, there the rabbi was powerful enough that he wouldn't let them take down the machitza. You're aware of that. And that shul remains with the machitza, and Montreal in general has the highest percentage of Shmirat Shabbat of probably any city outside of Israel. Probably overtook Antwerp. They say Antwerp. In Montreal, I would believe the percentage borders on 50%. A lot of Sfardim there, some Israelis. Then you have the Chassidim there, the Tusha Chassidim, so they have a very high percentage. I was in a shopping mall there, and I couldn't believe how many stores in the mall were Shomer Shabbos. So, tremendous battle. Then you come to the service, playing games with the service. And here, every rabbi was at the mercy of the congregation, the Balabatim. But what do they mean by playing games? In the shuls that remained Orthodox, well, they wanted English readings. Are you allowed to? We spoke about this, I think, last year. English readings, all right. You can reach a compromise. You can be flexible. All the major Orthodox shuls had English readings. The problem gets worse when they want to play with the nusach in the tefillah. And there you have the conservative movement already, where they changed the musaf. This is in the 1950s, Asher hikriv lefanecha. When we say v'nakriv, that we should bring these kabbonet in the future, they limited the kabbonet, hikriv lefanecha. Ancient history, not today. And here already it's a question of a sitter and a nusach, and Balabatim, and belief, and apikursis, and bringing religion up to date, and all the nice words that go with it. And that's what the Meisher is telling him. If it's a question of running a shul, and you're dealing with Balabatim that are distant from Yiddishkeit, and who drive to shul, and who knows what the kashrut is in their homes, and you have all these problems, don't leave the shul. The fact that you're there, who knows, it can make it better. It can have an influence, if not on the Balabatim, on their children. But when it comes to the Kedushat Veikneset, there the rabbi has no choice. What do you do if they take the machitza down? And I'll make one more comment. What do you do if they want to change the sitter, bring in the Silverman sitter, that was the famous conservative sitter, the Gordas sitter, and little changes. But these changes already indicate a totally different way of thinking, a totally different approach. And there the rabbi, what can you do? You have to leave in dignity, or ultimately you become a conservative rabbi. There's one more point I want to make here. Yes, it's true. that in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, into the 60s, many Orthodox rabbis had synagogues where there was no machitza. But in those situations, we're talking about where lachatchila there was no machitza. It's not that they're taking down a machitza. You have to differentiate. Where they're taking down a machitza, there's very little the rabbi can do, and you can see the balabatim are dead set to reform, to innovate. Where it's a question of taking a shtela without a machitza, there you need guidance, what the situation is. And that's where you hear stories correctly. So Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Belkin, it could even be before in the 30s, they were agreeable, take the shtela for 2 years, let's see if you can influence, let's see if you can inspire. Did it always work out positively? Absolutely not. Sometimes these rabbis went in, 2 years later they had to leave. Sometimes these rabbis went in and 2 years later they asked no questions. They were part of the conservative scene, even if they remained Orthodox in their own practice. And there's the classic example of Rabbi Shlomo Lariskin, which everyone talks about, which he writes about, which I was a living witness to everything that happened, where he goes into the shteller on the Upper West Side and he agrees to become the educational director. He's not willing to call himself rabbi, but within a year or two, his influence is so great, so far-reaching, that the Balabatim agree to put a machitza in. And Riskin Shul goes mechayil al chayil. First there was a small machitza, then there's a large machitza. Today it's already long since Rabbi Riskin left. I have to be honest, I don't know how many Balabatim there remember his name. There's a rabbi, an English gentleman, I believe the name is Robinson, who has caught on, and there were many rabbis after Rabbi Riskin. None of them caught on. They were still in the shadow. They couldn't compare to him. But finally, they have a rabbi, and they moved to a new location. They made a whole deal. They sold the building. They had another building. They had air rights, a big building, an apartment house is on top of the shul, if I'm not mistaken, and they have a whole new shul with a 100% properly valid machitza. So this is Reb Meisha. This is Reb Meisha giving advice. This is Reb Meisha never dealing with these rabbis and dealing with their problems. And my heart goes out to the rabbis because this haunted them. Today it's a different America. No one has to deal with machitza. Today when a rabbi, Yehi Mishpach, wants to take a shtel, in my time there was one question. Are you willing to take a shul without a machitza, or are you insistent upon a machitza? That was the only question they asked you. Today, the rabbis have to follow form, and today the issue is women, women, women. Now we got involved with the new issue, with the homosexuality, with the transgender, with all that goes on in the modern world, and Nebuch, the rabbis have many, many different questions. I saw a list of about 20 questions they were asked. The simplest ones were something like, will you allow women to dance with a Sefer Torah on Simchas Torah? Another simple question was, will you allow the Torah to be passed from the men's section to the women's section? The Torah is taken out on Shabbos so the women can kiss the Torah. And you follow, these are the questions, they go on and on. Will you allow a woman to speak during the davening in place of the rabbi if she's a spiritual lady from Israel visiting, an expert in Tanakh, and she will preach the sermon? Will you allow the president of the congregation, who is a woman, to make the announcements after davening while the men are still sitting there with their taliyot on? And the questions go on and on. Now, of course, with the homosexuality and the transgender issues, wow, I pity the rabbis who have to answer these questions and deal with it on a daily basis. But life moves on, and this is the reality, and I think Reb Meisha is absolutely right. We have to be positive. Somehow, we are confident Torah will win out. Tamura u kitov, and Torah will win out. So, to reiterate, we're scratching the surface, but it's a very difficult shaila and an emotional shaila, because I have to say, when I walked out of Stamford, Connecticut, and I see the cars pulling out of the parking lot, it's like a knife at your heart. Here's an Orthodox shul, and here's a kid who just stopped in Musaf. I said Kedusha to his Kedusha. I responded, and take a look. They're driving away on Shabbos. All right, this is not a simple, pure halachic shaila. But Reb Menashe Klein, you can see he's amorphous in his ultimate answer. Do the best you can and try to convince them no Chilul Shabbos. Take walk, no bus, don't carry. Well, if you're a Jew who just arrived from Russia, I don't know how you're going to react. I'll never forget that one of the famous refuseniks finally got out. They were living in Ramat. This goes back to the mid-1980s. And they met me at some Russian affair. And she's a professor and he's a professor. And they said to me, Rabbi Rakefet, you're so intelligent. How can you believe in all this narishkeit? Not doing malacha on Shabbos, kosher. It's crazy. That's their attitude. Brainwashed by the communists. Professors. Who needs religion? Who needs the Baruch Hashem? They're bigger than God. Bigger than any restriction. A modern person should have restrictions? How do you believe in this? Not plain and simple. So, all right, Reb Menashe Klein is doing what he can. But halacha l'maisa, we can do the best we can, but we have no guarantees. The chaplaincy problem just shows you the question repeats itself. Forget about Yomo getting off the plane and coming to New York, a language that he doesn't know a word yet of English, and all the adjustments. What's the problem with the plane? You came by boat?
The plane. I had a year and a half of English in school before I
came. How much English did you know? A year and a half in Russia, cut it out. The kids in Israel have a year and a half, and believe me, they're still their English leaves a lot to be desired. I have some great-grandchildren who speak English perfectly and some who leave a lot to be desired. Thank God for the computer on that level. It forces them to learn English. You follow? Reb Moshe's two tshuvot are epic making, because Reb Moshe doesn't just deal with Lifnei Iver. He throws in the concept of Mesit u'Mediach. And that already is very extreme. It's even though it's not Aveda Zara, there's no Chi of Skila, but Klape Shmaya, Reb Moshe is saying to us, it's like Eitz Hadad, Eitz HaChayim. You're reading from the apples. Which is worse, a lav or a Nisa Skila of Shabbos, Chas V'Chalila? Mot Yamut. Wow. But even Reb Moshe encourages the rabbis, there's nothing more you can do. Don't leave the synagogue. He tells Rabbi Kaplan, you've made a macha. Can't do any more than that. He tells Rabbi Naftali Kalbach, don't leave the rabbinate. Yes, most of the balabatim are makalei Shabbos, but kolzman you're there, you can set the standard. At least it doesn't change the kedushat Beit Knesset. But if the kedusha should change, then you have to leave. And that's the story of Machitza. It's a tremendous battle was fought in America. As I said today, those lines have been drawn. No one is pulling down Machitza. Even Shira Hadasha, which is far from, in my humble opinion, a Torah shul, but a Machitza they have. It's fascinating that no one will dare take down the Machitza. The women will be on one side, the men on another. The women will stand up front and lay in the Torah, Dabim Famamed, but the Machitza is there in the middle. I attribute that to Rav Soloveitchik, to Mori Urebi, that he fought such a tremendous battle for Machitza. People are hesitant to take it down, which may or may not be the reality, but that's the way I see it, that they know that the Rav, after all, they want to justify themselves. The Rav was modern, the Rav was Western, the Rav walked into the big world, but the machitza remained. So ad kedei kach, they don't want to change. Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way I understand it. All right, we've reached Reb Aaron Lichtenstein. We'll have to leave that for next week, but very fascinating. Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach, and then we head into Chabad. Very interesting material, but a question that haunts us until today. Tomorrow, Be'ezrat Hashem, we pick up just where we left off, Rabbi Dr. Leo Young, a man who shaped the modern Orthodox concept in the United States, the Upper West Side, the Jewish Center. The Jewish Center emulated across the entire world, including Toronto. The freebies. I have no one. Michael, can you give this to Yitz? Can you give this to Yitz? Can you give this to Yitz? Yomo, can you give this to Moshe? I don't know where he is today. Yomo, can I trust you to give all this to Chaim?
Yes.
Okay. Furthermore, Chaim, can you ask Chaim what is this all about? I found checks written out to Chaim Goldberg. Two checks, $729.93, $329.99. Signed by Sheldon Blumenfeld, with all types of instructions that these are real checks. If these are real checks, I got to make a shechiyono. I never saw anything like that in my life. See what it's all about. I want to show you a very interesting article and one of the freebies. Some of these freebies are fabulous. This is from Shavi, Brichim to you, from Shavi. That's the name. Pays to go to Shul Shabbos. You can get. I get Friday morning. Mm-hmm. I get so many wonderful freebies, but this is very frightening. The Reform and Conservative have taken over the Jewish Agency. All they're interested in is pluralism. And this is a whole analysis of their power and how they act here. Unbelievable. And we have the wrong man in the right place. You have Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, who, with that glorious name, doesn't know what Yiddishkeit is all about. Ein mal asad. Wow. You're not going to believe this. You're not going to believe this. But it's true. You've heard the name Danishevsky, who was the Rav of Slabodka. The Danishevsky family, Gedolei, Gedolei, Gedolei Yisrael. His YU, in my time, some of the brightest guys were Danishevskys. Here is an article, they found him guilty. I know about this. Balabatam from Kilat Jeshurun, a man killed his wife, a Danishevsky, in order to inherit all her money. Could you imagine the verdict? The jury found him guilty. What a story with the marriage, with the divorce, with God have mercy. Ad kedei kach, murder. Karen Uhlenbeck is the first woman to win the Abel Prize for Mathematics. It's a prize of only $700,000. What's so interesting about this? Have you studied men are from Mars, women are from Venus? How much has been written on the difference in personalities of men and women, and that women do not have the mind to be great mathematicians? Are you aware of that? They have the mind to be great biologists, chemists, but not mathematicians. And there are all types of theories why. And here's a woman, second to none in her mathematical achievements. A very interesting article on Velvel Kesselman. Velvel Kesselman died at 91. I taught members of his family. This was a Chabad Chassid who remained a Chassid of Mashpia, suffering exile, death sentences, no end to it, under Stalin's USSR. and he gets out, and he becomes a free man, an inspiration to Chabad, interesting pictures. What achievements. Very interesting about YU. In the mosque in Washington Heights, they held a vigil for the 50 killed in New Zealand, and YU students went to the mosque and paid their respects during the vigil. All right, food for thought. Very, very interesting what comes up in this world and what they do. This is a letter written by Rav Elul Dobryska Rav. Yinuchamu b'kiflayim malatu kvod, and it doesn't tell you who it's written to. It's censored. It's written to his nephew, Mori Rebbe, Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, and it's Rav Elul just found out that his brother, Rav Moshe, died. And it's a beautiful letter of Tanchumim. It's right after Rav Elul reached Israel, saved from Hitler, and it's later. Rav Elul did not know right away. He only found out months later that his brother died, for obvious reasons. He was in Europe, he was hiding from the Nazis. Finally, they got him out. And a beautiful, beautiful letter, but it doesn't tell you to whom, probably on political reasons, lo aleinu. And finally, a letter from a dear, very incapable student, very bright, and he was in YU from 1979 to 1983. And he knew all about this letter, you know, that they claim is a forgery. And he knows already that they're blaming this particular individual. And he knew the individual they're blaming. To the best of my memory, I don't recall him once espousing the views of Meir Kahana or attacking the presence of Arabs in Israel. Most, if not all, of his diatribes were attacks on people who didn't spend enough time learning or teaching Torah in the way he felt it should be done. This individual set a personal example of Mesirat Nefesh, spending every waking moment learning and teaching without getting any compensation. And Vic Snow can testify to that, because he came to the East Side weekly and taught there as well. He seemed to support himself through some investments that he made. That's why it didn't surprise me to hear he sent out letters warning various communities about rabbinical candidates they were considering who he felt were unfit. But we'd be surprised to hear him write to President Herzog about not meeting with Meir Kahana Zal. So again, here's someone who knew the person whose name they're throwing around. I don't know how we'll ever solve it, but maybe someone knows should come forward. That's history today. It would be good to put it into context. Finally, on a most mundane note, this individual heard me say that the heating system in my building broke, and he writes to me, I hope they can fix it, you recover, and I have to tell you, we decided not to fix the heating system. It would be so expensive. And since half the building cut themselves off from central heating, everyone is going to cut themselves off from central heating. And yours truly has yet to figure out how I will replace it. I do have air conditioning units, which I just put in with heat, which are saving our lives now. I have two other modern type heaters. They convey air. And we'll have to figure out if we have to do more and how to do it. But Ribbono Shel Olam, Ot Hayad Netuya. I want to thank everyone for coming. Be'ezrat Hashem at 9:05 a.m. tomorrow. We pick up where we left off. And until we meet again, in health and happiness, Das V'danya. Thank you.
What Rav Moshe is saying is, your rabbi is saying, you don't have a morning, you don't have a